Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5pm.
Melbourne's Drive Time Radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
It's so early, the sun hasn't even begun to poke its head above the horizon, and the birds haven't even yet started their morning songs. This is Nathan's favourite time to walk, because it's peaceful. Before leaving his flat, he picks up a bucket of chalk, slips a couple of joints into his pocket, and cues up some music on his headphones. Today, it's Tibetan monks chanting. The steady rhythm helps him stay calm and centred. He lights a joint and walks towards the ocean, in the quiet of the morning, guided only by the stars and street lamps. Along the way, Nathan stops occasionally to cast a spell with his chalk. He writes the word love on the ground and surrounds it with a heart. Further along, he writes peace and draws the peace symbol. These chalk spells are one of the many ways he sends positivity into the world. The book in which this journey to the shore is described is called Shamanic Journey, and its author, Nathan Bell, is here with us today on Brainwaves on 3CR to talk about mental health and creativity. Welcome, Nathan, and thanks for joining us on Brainwaves this evening.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I guess before we get started, I was hoping you could share with us, what is a shaman in your view, and what role does a shaman play in culture?
Well, I suppose the idea of the shaman is rooted in tribal civilization, an ancient civilization, and it would be the mystic or the medicine man of the tribe who has special knowledge that others in the tribe do not have, and has knowledge of traditional medicine and also spiritual healing, matters of spiritual healing. And so in our culture, it doesn't play a particularly relevant role, but in many Indigenous cultures, the idea of the shaman is a status that you can have in the community in many cultures. I'd like to see it become more prominent in our culture, and I think it is starting to make its way into our society through some of the trends that are emerging.
And could you share with us what Shamanic Journey is about and what inspired you to write it?
Well, I had a psychosis which I found deeply profound and spiritual. I've always been very agnostic. I think that atheism and not believing in deities and spirits is probably the valid assessment to make of the world, but I'm open-minded about the idea that there could be these other forces in the universe. And I had a psychosis which was very spiritual, where I had some profound visions and some very mysterious, almost supernatural experiences happened to me, which puzzled me and left me quite baffled as to what had happened and how that could have really happened. And so it took me many years after that, probably 5 years after that psychosis, to write Shamanic Journey. But Shamanic Journey is a part of a series of short stories I've written which depict that particular psychotic episode, which at the time I considered a spiritual awakening. And I still reflect on that episode as being a deeply profound period in my life, where I was pursuing an understanding of life and I was coming to terms with mortality and trying to learn about the nature of the universe, all ideas which I reflect upon in the story.
You dedicate Shamanic Journey to all the wonderful neurodiverse people of the world, and the schizophrenics, and the bipolars, and the autistics. Why were they in your mind while you were writing this book?
Well, it's interesting because I did a lot of reading, and I don't know how many of the ideas I found on the internet were valid, but I do think there are ancient interpretations of conditions like schizophrenia. And I think you can find examples throughout history. Joan of Arc is one, a woman who many say had bipolar schizoaffective disorder, who had profound visions and felt she had clairvoyant psychic abilities, and was praised as someone who had extra knowledge. So I think in a lot of traditions, they interpreted the schizophrenic in the tribe as having been touched by the hand of God or having had some special power. So that's important to me because even though it may not be valid to say that a schizophrenic has any special knowledge or has been touched by the hand of some deity, being a shaman rather than having a mental illness empowers, gives reason to the experiences that an individual has and gives those experiences meaning. So it's an empowering position if you're a schizophrenic and you say, no, I interpret this as me having mystical powers. But the thing is, it's probably not valid. You don't really have any mystical powers, and that sort of thinking can be very dangerous as well. We've all heard the old one about the schizophrenic who thinks he can fly and jumps off a building and dies. So you have to draw a careful line if you want to start thinking about that line of thinking. But I value neurodivergence because we don't want everyone to have the same thinking. We want diversity in how people think in our world. We want a variety of exciting and new and fresh ideas. So I champion people who have different ideas, especially if they're sensical ones that can actually be backed up with some logical reason and aren't just silly ideas. So that's why I was thinking of those people when I wrote Shamanic Journey.
Throughout the course of the book, you pass several faces on your early morning walk. I believe that they're people that you knew and, you know, just from town. And you mentioned that they become possessed and they deliver sort of messages to you, spiritual messages. Have any of the people that you did pass in that book had the opportunity to read Shamanic Journey, and what was their response to their appearance in your book?
No, none of them have yet. And there's one woman in particular, the woman who says that she knows the secrets of the ancient Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, and she hasn't read the book yet. She hasn't read any of my books yet, but she's one of my big supporters. And I often wonder if she read it, whether she'd even realize that was her. And the funny thing is I've never heard her mention anything about mysticism or magic since then. It was this totally random remark, and this was what was happening at the time. I was having all these strange coincidences and signs in the environment around me, and I seemed to be having all these bizarre conversations with people, and that's how I became fixated that people were being possessed by entities to communicate messages to me, because I came across people who just said such bizarre, unusual things that were so out of character. I thought, well, why would you say that? Why would you say that? So it had to have some greater meaning, so it just didn't seem out of place. But it was such a phenomenally bizarre experience, that psychosis. Mm-hmm. Very bizarre.
There's a few rituals you practice in the book. Besides sending messages into the world by writing statements on the street in chalk, you also describe the act of picking up litter to be a part of your ritual and a part of your spirituality. Some people out there might not understand how picking up litter could be considered spiritual or ritualistic. Could you describe why to you this is a ritualistic act, and or at the time that you were, you know, writing, the period that you were reflecting upon, could you sort of explain how that's a, you know, that's a ritualistic practice for you at that time?
Well, with the spells and the rituals that I was doing at the time, and my thinking at the time was that each time I do a certain act, say picking up the litter, that act of picking up that litter firstly tributes the Mother Nature spirit, shows her that I care and that I am willing to serve her spirit and her well-being. And each time I do the act, imbues the universe around me with an energy of support for the earth, I suppose, and concern for the well-being of the earth. And each time I do the act, reinforces that energy further. So it's not about doing the act once. It's about repetitiously doing the act over and over again to continue to reinforce that energy. And the idea I had in my head was that that meant that the whole city that I was walking around picking up litter in, Newcastle, would become imbued with this energy of caring for nature, and that that would seep out and sort of infect, I suppose, other people and share that vibe with them. Like, it's interesting. I also used to walk around and tap surfaces, and I would tap surfaces and say love. And this was one of my spells. So I'd go, love, love, love. I'd tap all these surfaces and say love. And the idea was that I was passing my desire for people to have loving lives into all these surfaces. So there was this energy field around the city of love and compassion. So, yeah, it's very interesting way of thinking, which you could call very delusional. But I was very immersed in that for a long time, and I did those sort of repetitious ritual behaviours a lot. And, of course, obviously it's that the fundamental core of all of this is a concern for the welfare of Mother Nature, whether Mother Nature is just the planet, or whether Mother Nature, or whether the planet actually has some conscious spirit, is irrelevant. I'm concerned about the welfare of the planet, and that was what was at the foundation of casting that spell to tribute Mother Nature.
Throughout the book, you mention a voice in your head warning you that a world-ending war will soon arrive. Is that voice you mention an inner voice people might understand as the voice that they hear when they're, you know, just thinking, or is the inner voice you refer to, is that, was that a part of your the psychosis that you were experiencing at the time?
It was very different to inner dialogue. I have constant inner dialogue anyway, and it's very different to that. I had very standout voices which were very distinct from my own thinking and seemed to come from an external source. They're just hallucinations, obviously, but they were very powerful. And there were many instances where I heard these voices, and a couple of them in reference to nuclear war. I've also had ongoing dreams about nuclear war for a large portion of my life, which is, you know, that's apparently a very common reoccurring dream which a lot of people have, so there's nothing unusual about that. But at the time, it fed into my delusions. But no, very distinct standout voice separate to my inner dialogue.
And did it have a name, or, you know, or a personality that you could identify as well?
A masculine voice coming across as some sort of angelic being, some presence that was, I suppose, had a righteous feel to it, or a just feel, some being of justice, some righteous being that was, it had that feel to it. I don't know how to describe that, but it had a righteous, angelic justice feel to it, as if it was some spiritual entity.
Yeah. And also something that, because it's quite a prominent theme throughout the book. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, to be frequently reminded that a global catastrophe is on the horizon, you know, it must be incredibly sort of unsettling at the time, I'd imagine. And, you know, how do you manage those types of feelings that come with that sort of knowledge? And are there things that you do to, you know, soothe your soul during those times, or, you know, when you are feeling overwhelmed, if it is provoking certain emotions and thoughts? Is there anything that you did at the time to?
It's interesting, because I would honestly say I do get very overwhelmed by the world, because I'm very politically aware, and I was raised in my family. We're a very political family, very left-wing family, and we discuss all of these matters of geopolitics and global unrest and war and uncertainty regularly when we meet. I don't live with my family, but when we meet, and all through my childhood, we discuss those things. So my honest answer to you, sadly, would be that I do get very overwhelmed by some of the concerning things that happen in the world and the state of the world. And I do think there is always an ever-present risk of nuclear war, so long as there are nuclear weapons. What do I do to relieve myself of that anxiety? Well, I try to just get out on the street and sell my books or work on one of my stories. But honestly, if I'm honest with you, I'm a very aware guy, and those concerns are pretty much with me 24/7. I think about those things a lot, so I don't know how much relief I actually get from them.
In your book, one of the topics that you do ponder was the question about love and whether it's the result of metaphysical forces or a product of reproductive desire. You seem to conclude it's simply a result of brain chemicals, but despite this, you still feel that love has a really powerful impact on the universe. Could you talk a bit about how, in your view, something seemingly as banal as biology can have such a tremendous impact on the universe?
Well, it's interesting because I think if you asked a scientist, a relevant scientist, I don't know who the relevant scientist would be, but they'd probably tell you love was just the result of chemicals and reproductive desires. But we do such powerful things because of love. And look at how people behave when they're in love, in relationships, and the goodwill they will share and the good actions they will take. And the great lengths that people will go to express love, and a sense of love and compassion also unifies people to act in the greater good and for common causes. But you could also say that sometimes love can cause bad decision making. So I suppose it's about how love affects our decision making. A sense of love can affect decision making in a very positive and a very negative way. So it's a very powerful thing. And I prefer not to, in my day-to-day life, whittle love down to just being chemicals in the brain or the desire to reproduce, because that's quite a depressing way to view the world. So even if love is some fiction that we imagine in our minds, I think it's a good fiction that we should embrace. And that's why I sometimes get a bit worried about saying that everything is just chemicals in the brain, because it detaches us from a sense of feelings and emotions, which we should embrace.
Just to continue down that road of meaning and trying to find meaning, I found that in the book there is this real yearning to find meaning. In one of the parts you write, if the universe is just particles in the void, then there is no inherent meaning other than the subjective meaning we create in our minds. You go on to say that you hope that's not the case. Can you talk a bit about what that's like when you are experiencing those sorts of existential conflicts?
Well, again, that's another thing where I don't really ever get any relief from that, because I think about those things constantly. And I suppose I do think more people should think about those things a bit more, and then they might have better understanding of their place in the universe. But it weighs me down to think about those things as often as I do. Meaning is important, but meaning is subjective. And if you take a nihilistic atheist view of the universe, then the only meaning that exists is the meaning that we create in our own minds. And I hope that isn't the case, as I say in the book. But anything otherwards would require some sort of deity or defining spirit or energy to say this is the meaning of the universe. And some people don't like the idea of some divining deity saying that there is some meaning or grander purpose. So each to their own. The meaning that I find in myself is to live a life of love and of trying to bring something meaningful and positive into the world. But honestly, I am a bit of a nihilist, and it can get a bit depressing. So we should focus on the meaning we create and looking for our own sense of satisfaction in life, and giving something back to the world that's worthwhile.
In your book, you reflect on the times you've walked through graveyards and thought to yourself, it's as if these people never existed. You write that even men like Jesus leave a lasting memory, but even he'll be forgotten one day. This passage, it reminded me of a short story by the neuroscientist David Eagleman, in which he states there are three deaths that we experience. The first one is where our heart stops beating. The second one is when we're buried. And the last death we experience is when we're mentioned for the last time. Do you think there's solace to be found that, you know, after enough time, we'll all one day be anonymous, no matter who we were in life, and, you know, to one day be particles in the void, as you say? Or is that a difficult thing to sort of ponder?
I think it just is the nature of the universe as far as we understand. Look, I'm a funny guy. If I could live for tens of thousands of years and travel around space exploring other worlds, I will. A lot of people say, I'm happy with 100 years. I would live much longer if I could. I think you never run out of things to do. I deeply cherish life. I cherish every breath and every opportunity to do things in the world and to participate in the world. So I would live for far longer if we could. It is just the nature of the universe. And as I said, I'm a bit of a nihilist, so I accept that everything will come to a climax eventually. I'm not going to say I find solace in it. I wouldn't be telling you the truth if I said I found solace in it.
There's another passage in your book that I'm curious about. You write, I wonder if I really have a destiny or if I'm just a mentally ill man. I think this is a really good example of some of the self-doubt that lots of us living with mental health struggles do feel from time to time. For example, someone experiencing anxiety's heart might fiercely race in their chest because they sense danger. Someone with ADHD might experience rejection sensory dysphoria when they're criticized. Someone with borderline personality disorder might worry a friend is going to abandon them because they don't, you know, really like them. In these examples, the person with anxiety might question, you know, is there really danger? The person with ADHD might ask themselves if that person really was having a go at them. And the person with borderline personality disorder might wonder if they're just being paranoid. You know, they're all horrible feelings. It's like we can't trust ourselves or, you know, we feel the need to question our reality, you know. How do you deal with moments in life when you feel the need to, you know, question your perceptions of what's true?
Well, I'm always seeking to further my understanding of the world. Some of the experiences I've had took me away to almost another plane of existence. And in that period of my life when I was in that state of mind, I was constantly questioning because it seemed so bizarre to me what was happening, the experiences I was having, the hallucinations, the delusions, the voices, the visions. The whole psychosis was just so bizarre, but I seemed to retain some ability to look at it with a critical mind, and I had to question my reality a lot during that period. I think I've just learned just to be settled that I have a good grasp on the world and a good understanding of the world because I do a lot of reading and I follow news and politics and science. So I think I've just learned to have a bit of confidence in my own worldview at this stage. But I'm always growing and always enhancing my worldview as well. I don't doubt myself as much as I used to. I used to have a lot more self-doubt, but I've gotten a lot more confident over the last few years, so I'm trying to retain that confidence.
Do you think it's a skill that other people can develop with time or with some guidance from someone who actually does have experience in sort of, looking at the world in that kind of way and sort of taking a step back and going, you know, thinking sort of critically about ourselves? Is that something that people can learn, do you feel?
Well, I did Open Foundation when I was 25, which is the University of Newcastle bridging course. And that's where I first learned about critical thinking. And that really changed my life. And I think it's unfortunate in our society that sort of critical mind and the education to have that sort of critical mind is really seems to be reserved for people who get to the university level of the education system. I really think we should be teaching children those skills from a much younger age. Personally, I think our society would function better if we were learning those critical thought and critical reflection skills at a much younger age. So I'd certainly change that if I had any say in it.
I'm curious what your thoughts about this might be, but the philosopher Alfred Schultz, he wrote that we live in an intersubjective world, a world populated with people who all perceive reality differently, you know, individually, but we still share a common sense. As a matter of practicality, for example, we know that if we don't drink enough water, we'll become dehydrated, or we shouldn't jump off a building because we'll break our legs. Like we need to agree upon certain things in order to survive. Those of us who struggle with our mental health might feel pretty isolated because we do kind of have a different way of looking at the world, you know, especially those of us who diverge further away from what that common sense may be. Do you think art is a tool that can be used to bridge that gap in understanding between those whose common sense do differ dramatically from others, or, you know, is the artist's journey kind of a bit of a lonely one?
I'll say a few things on that. So I do think art is a bridge, and that's why I've written Shamanic Journey, The Wizard and the Iron Man. And now my next story coming out is The Wizard Spell, which is the third story about that psychosis. And I've written those stories so that others who aren't familiar with that experience can learn about what that state of mind is like, and they can try and empathize. So I think art is the bridge to convey that state of mind to people who haven't experienced it, and that's what I'm trying to achieve with the stories. With regards to we all have a common sense about the world, I think you're right. Most people do have a common sense, but there are always outsiders, and we are fundamentally individuals with our own perception and thinking. So I think there isn't really this common sense. There's some general ideas which most people come on board with, but there's always outsiders. And I've come across this a lot in my life in people's perceptions of me, because I sell books on the street, and I get a lot of people, because I sell art on the street, a lot of people come up to me and ask me if I'm homeless. Now, I'm not homeless. That's a perception, and my perception is correct. I'm not homeless. I know I'm not homeless. I know I'm on the street selling my books because I want to be a successful author. And other people have a completely different perception, and they're convinced that their perception is correct, and the two perceptions clash. And this happens a lot in the world. So I think art is a strong bridge for connecting people so they can see each other's worldviews and perspectives, which will further people's empathy for each other and help us come to a better understanding of each other, because I think people need to come to a better understanding of each other in this world before we can all start to solve some of the larger problems of the planet.
You've actually been a creative person for a very long time. Not just writing, but you've also involved in music as well. I think that was sort of the first, I don't know if that was the first sort of creative pursuit that you engaged in when you were, I think, a teenager or something.
Oh, yes. Look, right through my 20s, I was working on some very Rage Against the Machine style political music. I did political hip hop. I was in a band. We wrote a lot of anti-war songs, particularly anti-Iraq war, because the Iraq war was still going at the time. We produced music videos, and we produced two albums. That was under Hadron C, named after the Hadron Collider, and that's all still on YouTube. So I've been creating content for 20 years, because I'm nearly 40 now, and I started really seriously creating content when I was 20. So I've had a long run of creating content, and I will continue creating content until I die.
And with the just in regards to creativity in general, do you feel that it is a way that we can create meaning when we are struggling with the those sort of nihilistic feelings that might creep in from time to time?
Well, I think that's why I value the arts, and I think it's a shame that so many people don't value the arts. You know, I value stories, and people just diminish the value of entertainment. Content in general, they say, oh, that doesn't serve any practical purpose. Well, yes, it does, because joy and happiness and having a good time is an important part of living a quality life. We want to be entertained. We want to have movies that give us joy and happiness and tell us stories so that we can explore our understanding of the world. I could probably go and get a degree in history or law or some field where I could be an academic, because I'm intelligent enough to be an academic. So I could probably write papers and do research papers and contribute to life that way. But I would rather tell a story that has a deeper meaning embedded in it, and that gives people joy and also provokes them to think about life and their own life. So that's how I prefer to provoke thought, through stories rather than through creating a paper or some research paper or something.
Yeah, and speaking of your artistic practice, you're part of an organization called Reliability, so that's Rely-ability. Could you share with our listeners who Reliability are and what they do?
Reliability is an NDIS-funded creative arts service. So most of our staff have university qualifications in the creative industries. We have three staff who've done degrees in animation. One staff who's done a degree in creative industries. In the past, we've had music staff who completed degrees at Newcastle Conservatorium of Music. So majority of our staff are highly qualified in the creative industries, and we pair people with mental illness and disability with those staff. And basically the clients come in and say, this is my project. This is what I want to achieve. For example, I'm making a children's animation at the moment, a short film, which is a children's animation. So the client comes in and says, I want to do this. And they're paired with the appropriate staff member, and then they're mentored. So they're mentored through the process of doing that. And we work as we go and we learn as we go. And the clients are learning, and they're also completing projects and being guided to complete projects. So it's very much client focused on what the client wants to achieve, and their learning skills, and also coming out with a result at the end of the process. There's no tests, which is a great part of our service, because a lot of our clients wouldn't be in the mental state to sit through a TAFE course, because they wouldn't be up for the pressure of tests or exams. So here you just come in to our centre and you can just work at your own pace on your own goals, and you don't have to have that added stress of meeting expectations for deadlines. And a lot of people are really benefiting from the work we're doing here, and are getting a great deal of quality of life and satisfaction from seeing their projects come to completion.
What role does the mentors that staff reliability, what role do they play in guiding people to bring their creations to life?
Well, I think a lot of the role of the mentors is around teaching discipline, because as a lot of creatives will know, discipline to complete a project is one of the most important things you have to have. Everyone can come in with all these fantastic, grandiose ideas about creating live action movies or creating long running animation series or writing 10 book series of novels, but actually having the discipline to plan it out, to structure it, and then to work at it bit by bit with small goals, and then to finally achieve a completed project, that's where the mentors come in and sort of organise what's happening a bit better and give a bit of guidance around setting goals and making things actually happen so there is a result. They don't give much creative input. Sometimes mentors give a bit of creative input. It depends on the client, but it's really mostly it's about guiding them to actually get through the process of finishing a work. So
you actually became sort of involved in mental health advocacy pretty young, from what I understand. You were invited to speak at a lot of conferences and such. Could you share with me a bit about, you know, about the advocacy that you did over those years during that period of time?
Yeah, that was before the NDIS, so that would have been back in 2006, 2007, possibly a bit earlier, when I was in my early 20s. And it started with an organisation called STEP, Support Through Early Psychosis, where I was being supported to recover from a psychosis I had as a teenager. And it just came up one day that there was a conference, a mental health consumer conference coming up, and they were asking if anyone wanted to give a talk about their lived experience, and I volunteered. So I did that talk a month later or however long it was, and I wrote out a detailed talk about what I wanted to discuss. And at that time in my life, I was reading my talks off paper. I can just speak now. I'm much more confident, but back then I was reading off paper. And then it just went on from there. I said to them, I enjoyed doing that. Are there any other opportunities to do this? Then there was another conference, and I was actually getting paid, $150 to speak at a conference. And I was presenting a consumer's perspective on the mental health system and discussing consumer issues and my experience in the system. That was generally what it was about, and about my recovery and my goals. And anyway, it ended up, I did so much of it, I ended up giving about 100 to 150 of these talks over 4 or 5 years. I spoke to psychiatry students at University of Newcastle. I spoke to nursing students. I spoke to OT students. And I spoke at numerous conferences, and it was just a fantastic time. I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. I stopped doing it because I felt I had become too immersed in being a man with mental illness, and I just wanted to get back to being a normal guy and getting out in the world and living a normal life. But I was very immersed in that, doing that for quite some time, for 4 or 5 years, and it was good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, did that you did that experience, did that sort of equip you some with some of the sort of the confidence that you needed to express yourself creatively? Or
no, I think it's very much a foundation for where I'm at now. If I hadn't done that those years of doing that public speaking, I don't think I'd be as confident a speaker now. I don't think I'd be as articulate now. I don't think I'd be as good a writer now. It was a very pivotal, important period in my life. And it's worth noting that I did a couple of small training events through those opportunities that came up in that period as well. I did a course called Compelling Presenter Speakers Secrets, which was offered, which I was sent to by a mental health service. I think it was Nimai who I was working with at the time. So, yeah, it was a foundation period in my life where I learned a lot of skills about presenting discussions and about communication and communicating ideas in an adequate way where people could understand. Certainly a very important period in my life.
And from what I understand, you paint, draw and produce music. Is there, what's next for you on the horizon in regards to, yeah, creativity and art?
Probably three things. I've got a children's cartoon, as I mentioned, which should be finished in the next year, and I'm very excited to release that. I'm just finishing off a series of chalk pastel images called the Alien World series, and then I'm going to have an exhibition somewhere in Newcastle. It'll be my first solo exhibition. I've done one exhibition with Reliability, but I'm looking forward to my first solo exhibition. With regards to my stories, I've got three short stories which are in the third draft stage. So I'm just going to do basically one more run through of each story, which could take another month or two, and then I'll have a further three stories to release over the next 6 months. And I'm planning on having a launch for one of them, because it's about the loneliness crisis, because I've experienced loneliness in my life. And the story A Lonely Man, about the loneliness crisis, I'm going to have a launch for and try and make it a bit of an advocacy event around loneliness and isolation for people, because I think that's an important issue. And of course, I've got more music coming out, and I'm always putting more videos out. And once I finish one thing, it will just be time to start something else.
Yeah, awesome. So if any of our listeners are curious, where can they find your work? Where would they be able to listen to music or see your art or read your books?
My YouTube channel is Nathan Bell and the Revolutionaries. I have a Facebook page called Nathan Bell Artist, which I'm just getting more active with. My Instagram is Newcastle Art Resistance. My Redbubble is redbubble.com/people/modernculturenw, where you can buy my designs, which I do with support from Reliability staff. And you can buy my books on Amazon, Nathan Bell Author, Amazon.
Awesome. Well, I'll be sure to keep those links to those websites that you just mentioned on the Brainwaves page on 3CR. But yeah, thanks for joining us on Brainwaves this evening, Nathan. And yeah, I hope our listeners, yeah, enjoyed learning from you.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.